Thank you, Mr. Smith. It's good to see all of you today. Thanks for letting me come down. Becky's with me, so that's probably why you let me come. Why you want me down? But it is good to see all of you. We have known the Curleys. Obviously, they live much closer to us, and it was a sad announcement that we heard about Cindy. And Harry and Cindy have visited Eagle Rock from time to time, so she will be very missed. She's a very sweet lady. I want to take you back in time today to a time when a religious leader was revered among his followers. He was considered the most important figure in his faith. He had a very humble beginning. He was born to simple parents who had to hide their son from the king and a death sentence. Destined for great achievements by God's hand, so much so, he spoke with God. He spoke for God. He was considered a God. And after his death, his life took on near mythic proportions. During his birth, it was believed his mother knew no pain during childbirth. There was a light from heaven that invaded the room in which he was born. The room was filled with the light from heaven. He took on further divine proportions. He was further considered God's chosen deliverer, prophet, messenger, and mediator. He was quoted endlessly. He is quoted today. His statue, even today, is found in many seats of government all over the world. He is revered in thousands and thousands of places of worship. And his name you are very familiar with. It's Moses. You were probably thinking of another name. But Moses is who I was speaking of. Moses was my intent. And I'll tell you why. I think the two messages that you'll hear today are going to fit very closely together. What I'd like to do with you is examine one particular aspect of the Old Testament. And whereas it's a singular prophecy, I believe it has massive, epic proportion. In fact, of all the prophecies in the Old Testament, especially as it contains the Torah, it is probably, in my very humble opinion, one of the most very important. It is fulfilled in the New, and we will see in a number of instances in the New Testament, two sections in particular, we will view this prophecy and the new Moses. Our objective will be to see why this new or second Moses is the fulfillment again, of epic proportion. Turn with me, if you would, to Deuteronomy chapter 16 and verse 9. When I usually speak, I usually don't like to jump all over the Bible because that's not the way it was written. I like to take a section, I like to take it and analyze it and explore every facet, every angle, every corner of what it may mean and use as many sources as possible. This is not going to be the case today. And so I'll stop talking and start turning to it. It's obviously at the end of what we call the Torah, or that body of laws that Mr. Kozer referenced. So in chapter 16, verse 19 of Deuteronomy, if I can find it. Excuse me, 18. What am I doing? 18 and verse 15. When you make notes on top of your notes, the numbers start to look a little different. Deuteronomy 18, 15. Well, let's turn to another No, that's the one I want. It says, "The Eternal, your God, will raise up for you a prophet like me from your midst, from your brethren." And that enough is a prophecy of and all by itself. "Him you shall hear, according to all you desire to the Eternal your God in Oreb, in the day of the assembly, saying, 'Let me not hear again the voice of the Eternal my God, nor let me see this great fire any more, lest I die.' And the Eternal said to me," Moses, "'What they have spoken is good. I will raise up for them a prophet like you from among their brethren, and will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak to them all that I command him. And it shall be that whoever will not hear my words, which he speaks in my name, I will require it of him." And this is the prophecy. So first, in verses 9 through 13, God gives instruction that when they enter the land of Canaan, who will they listen to? It says, verse 9, It says, when you come into the land which the Eternal your God is giving you, back up to verse 9, same chapter, when you come into the land which the Eternal your God is giving you, you shall not learn to follow the abominations of those nations. There shall not be found among you anyone who makes his son or his daughter pass through the fire. And that was one religion in particular. Does anybody know what it was? It was to the god Moloch. Pass through the fire. Or one who practices witchcraft, or a soothsayer, or one who interprets omens, or sorcerer, or one who conjures spells, or a medium, or a spiritist, or one who calls up the dead. For all who do these things are an abomination to the Eternal. And because of these abominations, the Eternal your God drives them out from before you. You shall be blameless for the Eternal your God. For these nations which you dispossess listen to soothsayers, and they listen to diviners. But as for you, the Eternal your God has not appointed such for you. You will not listen to these people, God says over and over again. And he gives a number of descriptions of witchcraft, soothsayers, and omen interpretation, sorcerer. And we really don't know what they meant at that time. We only guess. But that's how many different facets of the world in which Moses lived, there were that many voices that people were listening to. And so verse 15 comes the prophecy. God will raise up for you a prophet like me from your midst, from your brethren. Him you shall hear according to all you desired of the Eternal your God in Oreb in the day of the assembly. Let me not hear again. Let me not hear again, they said, the voice of the Eternal my God, nor let me see this great fire. And so the prophecy says he's going to raise up a prophet, and that's the person you're going to listen to, God says, through Moses. And it's important. Who will they listen to? God says you will listen to this person who is like Moses. This is the prophecy. God will raise up this person, like unto the brethren, from his people. And God will put his words in that person's mouth, and to him you will listen. But what is the objective? The objective in the various translations that you may have on your lap is to be blameless, to be perfect. Don't listen to the soothsayers. Don't listen to the necromancers. Listen to God's prophet in order to be blameless, perfect, whole, complete. By what means? By the words of the prophet. Now, who would this person be? There are a number of possible answers. And this is how it is interpreted. There is a phrase called the singular collective. The singular collective is a word which, in the singular, it denotes a series of Mosaic-type prophets. In other words, Joshua, and all the parallels for Joshua, and there are many, Moses, Joshua, parallels, probably 20 to 30. He would have fulfilled that. Or Isaiah, Ezekiel, Jeremiah. In other words, a series of prophets, like Moses. From the people. He would be from Israel, from Judah, from one of the tribes. So that's one. That is shared by most Jews, for obvious reasons, and some Protestant scholars. And that is the dominant view of that group. But it is a minority view, the singular collective. Number two, an interesting fulfillment shared by millions of people, of the fulfillment of this prophecy. It's believed by Islam that Muhammad, look it up, Google it, that Muhammad is the fulfillment of this prophecy. He is a Semite, so was Moses. He speaks the words of God, so did Moses. He came to the Middle East, so did Moses. So he fulfills that typology. Research this and you'll see, and this is a dominant tenet of Islam. The third interpretation, it is culmination of one particular prophet, a prophet of prophet, who so mirrors Moses, and it is found in Jesus Christ, Jesus the Messiah. Obviously, that is the prevailing interpretation in Christianity. Over the last 20 to 30 years, there have been hundreds of articles, many, many books written on this concept of the fulfillment of this new or second Moses. It is our position in the church as well. The churches of God universally believe that the culmination of this prophecy in Deuteronomy chapter 18 is indeed Jesus Christ. For those of us within the churches of God, this prophecy, I believe, is unbelievably more important. And I'll show you why, hopefully, as we shall see as we go through this. So this prophecy is given in the book of Deuteronomy. It is great, great, deep meaning for us. It could be a foundational understanding, a premise, not a doctrine. But that's the crux of this message. So we begin with Moses. Moses was so identified with Israel and later Judaism and the other prophets in the Old Testament. Even Muhammad references Moses over and over again in the Islamic literature. In my opening, I made some claims as to the near mythic proportions of his stature, and they're all true. In Old Testament literature, especially rabbinic, as well as other writings for hundreds and hundreds of years, Moses is spoken. Biblical references first. He spoke with and he spoke for God. We saw that in Deuteronomy 18. That's a perfect example. So from the biblical record, he spoke for, he spoke with God. He communicated to Israel for God. He repeated exactly what God had told him. And you'll see throughout the Old Testament, the first four books, God said to Moses, Moses said to the people. God said to Moses, say to the people. He was God's spokesman along with Aaron. It's interesting. He is considered the effective author of four of the most important books in our Bible, the law. He has written Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, and Deuteronomy. So he is the author of some important books. We considered he was a god. I want you to think that one through. As God was preparing Moses and Aaron before they went back to Egypt, I want you to turn with me to Exodus chapter 6. It may be a verse you're not familiar with. I ran it by a couple of people. They weren't familiar with it. So in Exodus chapter 6, the preparation is beginning for Moses to return back. Remember, he was in Egypt. He fled to Midian. And he is now being prepared by God. In chapter 6, Mr. Smith said, if these lights get too bright or too warm, you could turn them off. I don't think I could see my Bible, Paul, without them. So I mean, I'm not struggling a lot, but let me see if I can't. There we go. Here we go. Chapter 6, verse 28. And it came to pass on the day the Eternal spoke to Moses in the land of Egypt. This is Exodus chapter 6, verse 28. The day that the Eternal spoke to Moses in the land of Egypt, the Eternal spoke to Moses saying, I am the Eternal. Speak to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, all that I say to you. So he's even the spokesman for God to Pharaoh. So the Eternal said to Moses, but Moses said before the Eternal, behold, I'm of uncircumcised lip, verse 30. How shall Pharaoh heed me? How is Pharaoh going to listen to me? I'm not good at this. You can see elsewhere, he said, please don't make me do this. Chapter 7, verse 1. So the Eternal said to Moses, see, I have made you as God to Pharaoh, and Aaron, your brother, shall be your prophet. You shall speak all that I command you. So Pharaoh will see Moses as God. The word there is Elohim. We could retranslate it and say, as a God. That is how Pharaoh will see you, as a God. And that's important, very, very important, as God, Elohim. It's a relative term, but God gives Moses incredible power and stature. For at the time, there was no one more powerful than the king of Egypt, the Pharaoh. He was considered what? A god. He was the son of Ra, the god of gods. And so God elevates Moses to this heavy, heavy responsibility. But he gives him preeminence of stature at the time. Moses is God's agent on earth. Is he not? He speaks with God. He speaks for God. He speaks with God as a friend, face to face, euphemistically. We'll talk about that. He had the power, Moses did, to change water into blood, whole oceans, seas, call down fire and hail from heaven, frogs and lice. Moses commanded it all. Yes, we know by the power of God, no doubt about it. But he could unleash plague after plague. And God, it was God's doing, excuse me, but Moses was his agent. It was his representative. From a human perspective, he was the deliverer of Israel. From a human perspective, and I refer you to Acts in the New Testament, chapter 7, verse 35, we won't turn there. He was Moses, the intercessor. He was the deliverer. He was the mediator for Israel to God. You wanted to get to God? You had to go through Moses. Moses had been selected by God. The rabbinic sources, early in the first century, some rabbinic authors claimed that Jochebed, Moses' mother, had no pain at childbirth, that light had flooded Amram and Jochebed's home the time of Moses' birth. Heaven descended, and light shone throughout the entire room the night he was born. Exodus Rabbah, which is, again, a rabbinic book or piece of literature, claims that, in fact, now follow me here, Amram, the father, divorced Jochebed, the mother, because during the time, Pharaoh was going to kill all the newborn males, correct? Remember that? Death of the male children? And so, this is rabbinic literature, this is not the Bible, but this rabbinic literature, Exodus Rabbah, claims that Amram divorced Jochebed because of this. Why get married and have kids? Pharaoh's going to kill them if they're a male. And while divorced, she became pregnant with Moses, resulting in a miraculous birth of Moses. This is in the literature. And this is the stature that built around Moses long after his death. This is the height, the epic heights that Moses attained after his death. Josephus, who wrote extensively, he was a Jewish historian around the first century. We'll quote him later. But we can easily see that Moses was and continued to be the par excellence representative of Judaism and continues today. We see his statue. We see him on the halls or seats of government. Go to most state capitals. Somewhere on the grounds, you will have a reference to the Mosaic Law. Our capital in Washington references Moses in at least six places. 3,500 years after his death. So it continues today. But how does all of this apply to the prophecy? Does Jesus the Messiah fit the bill? How closely does he fit the bill? And why is it essential for this new Moses to be understood in this context by us so that we can indeed apply it, as we heard in the opening prayer, as we heard in the first message, we can apply it in our lives and our understanding. And so, first, I want you to set the stage. Set the stage. I want you to turn to Exodus again, chapter 1. Yes, we will get out of Exodus, I promise. Exodus chapter 1, in verse 8. You know the story well, but I want you to key in on names and events as we read this short section. Chapter 8, verse 1. Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. I stop right there. How many of you have ever used that phrase? I've used it a number of times. It's kind of a catchphrase in modern terminology. When there's a new boss or new manager or a new president of a corporation, how's it going? Well, are you still in favor with the corporation? Well, there's a new pharaoh in Egypt that knows not Joseph. Meaning, the new guy doesn't know all the things that Joseph did. Let me translate. I was talking about where I worked and all the wonderful things I had done. This new dude shows up, and I've got to prove all over again to this new boss. No bueno. It's not good. I got to start all over. And that's what this phrase means. There arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. Joseph was second in command. He was the right-hand regent of the prior king. And he said to his people, the king of Egypt said, "Look, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them," whatever that means, "lest they multiply and it happen in the event of war that they also join our enemies and fight against us and so go up out of the land." They'll leave. They'll fight against us. They'll win. They'll leave. "Therefore they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with their burdens. And they built for Pharaoh supply cities, Pithom and Ramesses. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew." I mean, imagine hot, long day at work doing whatever, and let's have kids. I don't know how that fits together, but they had more kids. So the Egyptians made the children of Israel serve with rigor, and they made their lives bitter with hard bondage and mortar and brick and all manner of service in the field. All their service in which they made them serve was with rigor. So they made them servants of servants, and they were brutal to them. And we see in these first few verses. And they're afraid of losing the kingdom. So they make them work harder and harder. Let's continue. And in verse 15, then the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, of whom the name of one was Shipra and the other name was Puas. An interesting story. That Pharaoh goes to these two midwives. Can you just picture that? Right? It's kind of like the president of the United States or the king of some country going to a hospital in the birthing center and talking to two of the nurses that are help delivering babies. And he said to them, when you do the duties of a midwife for the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stools, if it is a son, you will kill him. But if it is a daughter, then she shall live. Another point. I was talking about this with one of my kids. And I said, now, if you wanted to stop people from multiplying, would you kill the men or male children, or would you kill the female children? Last I looked, men don't have children. Women do. That's a side point. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the male children alive. So the king of Egypt called all the midwives, called for the midwives and said to them, why have you done this thing and saved the male children alive? Well, they're lively. They get out before we can stop them. Obviously, verse 20, God dealt well with the midwives. They lied. God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and grew very mighty. And so it was because the midwives feared God that he provided households for them. So Pharaoh commanded all his people, saying, every son who is born you shall cast into the river, and every daughter you shall save alive. In other words, kill all the male children as they are born. A horrible, horrible, horrible thing. We switch now to chapter 2. Again, the story you know well. Verse 1, and a man of the house of Levi went and took a wife, a daughter of Levi. So the woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw that he was a beautiful child, she hid him 3 months. But when she could no longer hide him, she took an ark of bulrushes for him, daubed it with asphalt and pitch, put the child in it, laid it the reeds by the river's bank, and his sister, the child's sister, stood afar off to know what would be done to him. Now we know who we're talking about. We're talking about Moses. Who is his sister? Remember his sister's name? Miriam. Remember that. It's not mentioned right here. Then the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river. As her maidens walked along the riverside, and when she saw the ark among the reeds, she sent her maid to get it. And when she opened the ark, the little thing of bulrushes, she saw the child, and behold, the baby wept. So she had compassion and said, this is one of the Hebrews' children. Now, because there are children here, we're going to kind of brush over this at a high level of why, when the woman opened and saw the baby laying there, she knew it was a Hebrew baby. It was because of circumcision. The Egyptians practiced it, but not among their male children. And so that's how she knew. Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, shall I go and call a nurse for you from the Hebrew women, that she may nurse the child for you? And we know what happened after that. And so we see as the story continues, that Moses grows in the household of Pharaoh. Moses later, as you know, happens to unfortunately kill an Egyptian trying to help a fellow Israelite. He understands he is an Israelite. He flees to Midian. He meets God, who instructs him to go back to Egypt. He doesn't want to go. He doesn't want to go back. And so we pick up the story in chapter 4. So turn with me, if you would, to chapter 4. In chapter 4, we pick up the story in verse 13. Moses is saying, as we alluded to earlier, I don't want to do this. He said, O my Lord, O Eternal, please send by the hand of whomever else you may send. So the Eternal, verse 14, so the anger of the Eternal was kindled against Moses, and he said, is not Aaron the Levite your brother? I know that he can speak well. And look, he is also coming out to meet you. When he sees you, he'll be glad in his heart. Now you shall speak to him and put the words of his mouth, and I will be with your mouth and with his mouth, and I will teach you what you shall do. So he shall be your spokesman to the people, and he himself shall be a mouth for you, and you shall be to him as God. Again, very, very powerful. So not only is God, Moses is as a God to Pharaoh, he also shall have that aspect in a human sense to Aaron and the people. And you shall take this rod, Moses, in your hand, which you shall go and do signs. And we know that the rod was like a scepter, and this was a right of kingship. By the way, the Pharaoh, king of Egypt, he too had a scepter. All kings have a scepter. It kind of goes, you get a crown, you get a robe, and you get a scepter, and all the food you can eat. So that's the signs of king. That's a scepter, like a rod. And so we know the story well. We know the story well. And we wonder to ourselves, how does this happen? Why does this happen? And I want you to understand, he goes on to say, so verse 18, Moses went and returned to Jethro, his father-in-law, and said to him, please let me go and return to my brethren who are in Egypt and see whether they are still alive. And Jethro said to Moses, go in peace. Now the Eternal said to Moses in Midian, go, return to Egypt, for all the men who sought your life are dead. And Moses took his wife and his sons and set them on a donkey, and he returned to the land of Egypt. And Moses took the rod of God in his hand. Very powerful story. Very, very powerful story. Now, as we read this, let's recap. Joseph dies. A new king in Egypt arises. He seeks to kill all the male children to protect his kingdom. Moses is born. He is hidden. He flees to another land and returns to Egypt. As he returns to deliver God's people, and he does so because all that sought his life are dead. Now, I want you to put on your New Testament hat, your New Testament eyes, your New Testament brain. In fact, it's about 40 to 70 AD, first century. There is no New Testament. It hasn't been written yet. It hasn't been put together, and Nelson Publishing hasn't printed it yet. So there is no New Testament. Remember that as we read this. As we read this book, and we're going to Matthew, you're listening to it, or you're reading it for the very first time. You are a Jew. You're living in Judea, and you hear these words. Matthew chapter 2, if you would, please. In Matthew chapter 2, we will pick up verse 7. Now remember, this is the world around you. You're very, very well aware of the world around you, right? If I said Kobe Bryant and the Lakers are starting up a new season, I hope not. Is there anybody in this room say, who's Kobe Bryant? Right? If you go to Milwaukee and stop people on the street, if you asked them, who's Kobe Bryant, they'd say, plays for the Los Angeles Lakers, right? Does everybody know that? This is kind of like what I'm trying to... I don't know San Diego that well. What if I said, ever heard of a mayor that got imprisoned? Hello? Okay, never mind. This is local stuff that he's talking about. And Matthew begins in verse 7. Then Herod, who's Herod? He's king. When he had secretly called the wise men. Why is he called the wise men? We know this story. Do you know there's only two chapters in the Church of God we never hear talked about. It's Matthew 2 and the beginning of Luke. Very rarely, if ever. How many of you ever heard a sermon on Luke 2? No, three of you. Good. Good. It's the birth narrative. It's too close to that pagan holiday, so we're very careful about reading it. It's always done in context, as I'm doing now. So Herod, when he had secretly called the wise men, right? The wise men are coming because they saw the star. They saw the star because the birth of the Messiah. Something's happening. They determined from them what time the star appeared, and he sent them to Bethlehem and said, go, search carefully for the young child, right? This child's been born. And when you have found him, bring him back word to me so that I may come and I may worship him. And we know that's a lie. When they heard the king, they departed, and behold, the star which they had seen in the east went before them, till it came and stood over where the young child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced with exceeding great joy, and when they had come into the house, they saw the young child with Mary. What's the Hebrew name for Mary? Miriam. and his mother and fell down and worshipped him. And when they had opened their treasures, they presented him gifts to him, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. We think the father was there. What was the father's name? Joseph. Then, being divinely warned in a dream that they should not return to Herod, they, Joseph, Mary, and the baby, departed for their own country another way. The three magi. We don't know there were three. The magi returned another way. Verse 13. When they had departed, behold, an angel of the Eternal appeared to Joseph in a dream, saying, "Arise, take the young child and his mother, flee to Egypt, and stay there until I bring you word, for Herod will seek the young child to worship him." No, that's what Herod said. That was a lie. He said he will seek, the angel says, he will seek the young child to destroy him. When he arose, he took the young child and his mother by night and departed for Egypt, and was there until the death of Herod, that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by the Eternal through the prophet, saying, "Out of Egypt I have called my son." You got the wheels whirring right now? Huh? You got the wheels moving? Does this sound familiar a little bit? Then Herod, when he saw that he was deceived by the wise men, was exceedingly angry, and he sent forth and put to death all the male children who were in Bethlehem and in all its districts from 2 years old and under, according to the time which he had determined from the wise men. Then was fulfilled that which was spoken by Jeremiah the prophet, saying, "A voice was heard in Ramah, lamentation, weeping, and great mourning. Rachel weeping for her children, refusing to be comforted because they are no more." Now when Herod was dead, behold, an angel of the Eternal, another angel, maybe the same angel, but it was another instance, appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt, saying, "Joseph in Egypt," saying, "Joseph in Egypt," saying, "Arise, take the young child and his mother and go to the land of Israel, for those who sought the young child's life are dead." Then he arose, took the young child and his mother, and came to the land of Israel. Do you see any parallels? Joseph and Mary, dreams. God takes Jesus to Egypt. Why? The leader of the land, Herod, seeks to destroy him. Herod decrees that all males under 2 years old are to be killed to remove any threat to the chance of destroying his kingdom. In another dream, Joseph returns to Israel as Herod is dead, because in verse 20, "For those who sought the life of the child are dead." Note the points of similarity of what we've read. In both stories, there is a Joseph, the patriarch in Egypt, and Jesus' earthly father. There is Miriam, Moses' sister, in the New Testament, Jesus' mother. The death of the young male children at the hands of the king, in both readings, both to preserve power. Both Moses and Jesus were born to deliver their people, especially by God. Both sections reference Egypt. Matthew 2:15 says, "Out of Egypt I called my son," which is a whole other series of prophecies. Moses starts in Egypt, flees, and then returns to Egypt. Jesus starts in Israel, flees to Egypt, returns to Israel. In both sections, those who sought the life of the child in one case are dead. Matthew is interesting. The Septuagint Greek version of the Old Testament are near exact, word for word. Greek Old Testament, book of Matthew in the Greek. The wording and verb structure are almost identical. Those seeking your life are dead. There is in this section probably 10 to 20 separate individual parallels. Type, antitype. Moses, second Moses. It's called the Moses typology. Josephus, the Jewish historian, adds further perspective of the time. Oh, my book. Forgot to bring my book up. Can I grab my book? Is that okay? Can we do a timeout? Can we pause? Is it okay to hit the pause button? From Dale Allison's book on Moses, let me read just a very, very short section. The story of Moses, according to Josephus in Antiquities, chapter 2, section 210, Amram, the noble, pious father of Moses, was fearful, ill at ease, and at a loss as to what to do about his wife's pregnancy. For Pharaoh had decreed death for male infants. Being in such a state, God appeared to the man in a dream, exhorted him not to despair, and prophesied his son's greatness. In the story of Jesus, while Joseph, the just father of Jesus, is contemplating his course of action with regard to his wife's pregnancy, the angel of the Eternal appears to him in a dream and bids him not to fear, then prophesies his son's future greatness. The parallels in the New Testament and of the Jewish rabbinic writings of the time over and over show this parallel of what Moses was and how Jesus' life in Matthew parallels Moses' life. In Josephus, Antiquities, chapter 2, section 205, in the extra-biblical tradition, Herod slaughtered the Hebrew infants in Matthew because he learned of the birth of the future liberator. In Matthew, Herod orders the slaughter of Hebrew infants because he has learned the birth of Israel's liberator. Parallel after parallel after parallel. Those seeking your life, they are dead. One might ask, why did the writer here, Matthew, why did he not write more explicitly? Why didn't he just say it? Why didn't he just say that Jesus is the Messiah and he is this new Moses? He is the fulfillment of this prophecy in Deuteronomy. And you might ask that. Go ahead, ask it. So there are four of many, many reasons. Number one, God indeed gives layered depth at the things that we read. There are some very simple instructions. Very simple instructions. When I first came into, not the Church of God, but into Protestant Christianity, they handed me the book of John. John is a very plain book. In fact, when you learn Greek, they give you the book of John to read. It is very simple construction. It's very plain to read. Matthew, not so much. Not so much. And in this case, he gives at each level, as you dig down through the layers, you learn more. Biblical authors, as we well know, write in typology. They use metaphor. They use allegory. Jesus used parables. Not so much to hide forever, but to reveal to those who would dig. The ancient mind, always remember the ancient mind, had no books. None. Zero. Nada. They had scrolls, and the scrolls were unbelievably expensive, very expensive. The vast majority of people could not write or read. They did not need to. It wasn't necessary. You don't know. Most of us in this room don't know calculus. Some we do know. Some do know calculus. It's not necessary for everyone. Also, the ancient mind was much more adept to hearing and retaining. Their memories were vast. Whole sections of the Bible were retained word for word because there were few, if any, scrolls or pieces of parchment or papyrus. Memorization was the normal course of education. Lastly, because it may seem somewhat hidden to us, to Matthew, what he writes is in plain sight. If I could ask Doug, if you could, and Julian, if you could pass out, it's just a small little handout. I'm not sure if I have enough. We're going to have to share because John was cheap. John didn't know how many to... I want to examine the overall structure of Matthew versus the Torah, the book, the four books of the law. Matthew versus the Torah. I think I've got the word Pentateuch down. We could have added one for Joshua, but that... It's a typo. And you'll see when you get it, if you want to write this down, you can. Three vertical columns, one for Matthew, one for the Torah, and the explanation. And you'll see how the structure of Matthew fits. Come on. Did you two guys kind of hoof it? Now, Doug's walking even slower now that I said that. Yeah. Most everybody got one? Good. You'll see on there in Matthew chapters 1 and 2, in Exodus chapter 1, we read some of this, chapter 1 through 2:10, is the infancy narratives of both books. In Matthew chapter 3 and Exodus 14 It's called The Crossing of the Water. And this is from Allison's book, page 268. And you'll have another reference there of other parallels. But it's called The Crossing of the Water. It's a baptism. You think about the crossing of the Red Sea and Jesus' baptism in order. It's Matthew chapter 3, Exodus chapter 14. I put a side note there, a baptism in Corinthians 10, where it says, Paul says that when Moses had the Israelites pass through the sea, they were what? Baptized unto Moses. So even Corinthians has some Mosaic typology. Matthew 4, Exodus 16, the wilderness temptation. And so on and so forth. And I ask you to do this if you want to have some fun. If you want to have some fun and you like to study, I offer this to you. You've got 20 to 30 hours of study right here, of just comparing these two, and see the points, very obvious, of parallelism. And look for the typology. Moses, the new Moses. The events, the time periods, the manna coming from heaven during the wilderness wandering, Jesus calling down, I am the manna from heaven. And over and over and over again, he references it over and over again. The Exodus and the Passover are the most spoken about events in the entire Bible, from Genesis to Revelation. And so I give that to you along. There's a couple there to study. You know, without looking, let's pick this next one, Matthew chapter 5 and Exodus chapter 19. Help me out here. This will be a little bit of interplay here. It's the mountain of law giving. What happened first in Exodus chapter 19? Tell me. Who was on the mountain in Exodus 19? Moses. What did he receive? The law. From whom? God. So Moses on the mountain. He's on the mountain. He receives the law from God. He talks to God and descends with the law. Now we're going to move to Matthew chapter 5 and on in 6 and 7. Matthew chapter 5, 6 and 7 is known as the Sermon on the... What's the mount stand for? Valley. No, a mountain. So Jesus is on a mountain. It is one of the most concentrated references of the book of Deuteronomy in Matthew chapter 5. He is quoting again and again and again God's law, all in a positive light, as we know. And so you can check each one of these sections in parallel and see where there's this great concurrence, speaking about two different people, talking about, in many ways, some very, very similar things. Jesus and Moses are both on a mountain in Matthew 5 and Exodus. God speaks to Moses, who gives the law to Israel. Jesus, who is God, gives the law to Israel. Both quote Deuteronomy extensively. One's in Exodus. If Jesus is the prophetic fulfillment of the Moses Deuteronomic prophecy, and we believe it was Jesus as the fulfillment, who was the spokesman for God to Moses, let me ask you, would this new Moses, who we know as Jesus Christ, if he's the second Moses, he's the new Moses, would he bring a new law? A brand new law? New commandments? New understandings? New precepts? If he did, the first message is null and void. It's null and void. We shouldn't be quoting from the Old Testament at all. But we know better. He would not bring a different law. Would this second Moses abrogate, alter, destroy that law given to Moses if he was the second Moses, the new Moses? No, of course he wouldn't. We'll give you one more book. John chapter 1. If you'll turn to John chapter 1. Remember we said earlier that John is a much simpler book. He's very plain. So as we read John chapter 1, I want you to again, it's 50 to 60 AD or whatever first century decade you wish to use. You're listening to this the first time, you're hearing it, and this is what you hear. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him nothing was made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. And the light shines in darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it. If you were listening to this in Hebrew, or you were listening to it in Greek, you would have heard some of the very same exact words that you would have heard in the book of Genesis. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. Some of the same. It is not word for word throughout the chapter. It's not meant to be. It's made written for us to dig and to think. He does it for a reason. He does it for a reason. Type and typology. So John takes this other tack because his result is similar, but he goes a different way around it. So what does this remind us? The points of concurrence with Genesis. In the beginning, light, dark. John's gospel was written after Matthew's by most scholars. He was a disciple. He was a disciple that felt things were more theological. We do not see the same type of stories in John that we see in Matthew. John wrote differently. It's not considered one of the synoptic gospels. He sets the stage differently. He's more direct. Verse 14, jump over there with me. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld His glory, the glory as the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. The Word became flesh. The Word in the Greek is, as you may know, logos. It is the same word used in Greek for the law. It is the Word of God. The ten words are the ten logos. So when he says the Word became flesh, we would interpret that as Jesus Christ is the walking, talking embodiment of the law. Because we believe he gave it at Sinai after Passover as they were dwelling in the wilderness. While they were dwelling in the wilderness in tabernacles. The word in verse 14, and dwelt among us, is the word skenu. It is the word in Greek, does anybody know? For the word tabernacle. He tabernacled among us. He dwelt among us. And here again we have this mosaic wilderness typology. John, verse 15, bore witness of him and cried out, saying, this is he of whom I said, he who comes after me is preferred before me, because he was before me. Verse 16, and of his fullness we have all received, and grace for grace. For the law was given through Moses. Another reference. Grace and truth. There is no but in the original. The law was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. Can you see where Moses and the law, the Old Testament, Sinai and the wilderness, they're never denigrated. They're never denigrated. They're compared. Christ is superior. There is no question about it. That's the whole point. But it's put in contrast. Not that this is bad. This is good. Those bad old laws you quoted in the first message. Those bad Old Testament laws. No, they're not compared as negative and positive. They're both positive, but one is far greater. Far, far greater is the giver of this law. And so we continue. He goes on and says, it was here somewhere. Turn with me, if you would, same chapter, verse 19. Verse 19. Ugh, man, I don't need new light. I need new glasses or new eyes. We see an exchange here with John and those around him. This is the testimony, verse 19, chapter 1. This is the testimony of John when the Jews sent priests and Levites from Jerusalem to ask him, who are you? He confessed and did not deny, but confessed, I am not the Messiah. And they asked him, what then? Are you Elijah? He said, I am not. Are you the prophet? Ho prophetes. The word there means a singular individual. Are you the prophet? He said, no. And they said to him, who are you, that we may give an answer to those who sent us? What do you say about yourself? He said, I am the voice of one crying in the wilderness, make straight the way of the eternal. Isaiah chapter 40. As the prophet Isaiah said. Verse 24. Now those who were sent were from the Pharisees, and they asked him, saying, why then do you baptize if you are not the Christ, nor Elijah, nor the prophet? The prophet. The prophet, the Messiah, and the Elijah were the three things that they were looking for. These were the three people they were looking for. In another study, your own study, you probably know the two of them were one. The prophet and the Messiah, the Christ. Christ fulfills that role. I'll refer you to the book of John, give you a little bit of digging, if you wish, in John chapter 7. We're in the confession of one of the early martyrs of the church. He said he fulfills Deuteronomy 18. I think we've already proved that. So as the Baptist is questioned, it brings out the point that there was an great expectation in the first century of who is this prophet? Who is this prophet? In verse 43, maybe one last reference. Verse 43, again, just John chapter 1. We haven't even gotten out of John 1 yet. Verse 43, the following day Jesus wanted to go to Galilee. He found Philip and said to him, "Follow me." Now Philip was from Bethsaida, the city of Andrew and Peter. Philip found Nathanael and said to him, "We have found him. We have found him. Of whom Moses in the law and also the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph." Who was it that Moses in the law had written about? It was the prophecy. The singular prophecy of "There shall arise a prophet like unto me from among your brethren, he you shall listen to." And all the other messianic prophets, but there was one prophecy among all others. Jesus is the prophet of whom Moses spoke some 1,400 years earlier. Are we good for time? We got till 5, right? No, we'll be finished. There are dozens more areas of the New Testament, and you can Google this very easily and see the many papers. In the vast majority of cases, we would agree with almost every paper written about the concept of the new Moses. But they don't have the deeper understanding and acceptance of God's law that we do. Hence the comment I made about the first message. You see how much it fit in, Mr. Kozer, right? There are dozens more. In Luke, in 1 Peter, in Hebrews, 2 Corinthians chapter 10, we reference. I think the second section of that handout gives you even more work to work with. But we see a continual reference, all positive, to Moses and the law as God's representative. He is the lawgiver, the deliverer, the mediator, the Savior, and the prophet of prophets in the Old Testament. But Moses spoke of one who would come after him. Moses spoke. Turn back with me as we close in Deuteronomy chapter 18, not 16. In Deuteronomy 18, there is a very, very interesting verse in this section. He'll raise it for you, verse 15. "A prophet like for me in your midst from your brethren, he will hear all that you desired of the eternal your God in Oreb in the day of assembly, saying, let me not hear again the voice of the eternal my God, nor let me see this great fire anymore." I don't want to hear God anymore. Send us a man. We want to hear a man's voice. And the eternal, verse 17, said to me, Moses, "What they have spoken is good. I will raise up for them a prophet like you from among their brethren, and will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak to them all that I command." It said earlier, you will learn everything that you desired to learn of the eternal God at Oreb. What God didn't say, and how does this relate to God's church? What God didn't say, because he could have said, this new prophet will change everything I'm saying here. He will eradicate, nullify, and disavow all the laws that I've just given to you. Or this prophet will destroy the memory of what's happened here. You'll never have to reenact it again. He will be the antithesis of the law. Moses could have told the people that, but he didn't. But they said they don't want to hear the voice of God any longer. So God sent his son, who is very God, but in the likeness of man. So indeed, the prophecy is fulfilled in two ways. One, in the likeness of man, speaking as a man, which is incredible, but also as God, speaking for God. He combined a literal representation of God and a figurative answer to the prophecy. And we, of all people, want this connection. Jesus Christ so surpasses Moses in every way. every possible way. And we hear messages every Sabbath to that degree. I bring up Moses, and I don't lionize him, but I put him in comparison because he gave the prophecy that makes Jesus Christ who he is all the more important. This concept of the second, or new, or final Moses means all the more to us in God's church. And these concepts that we believe that are based on God's word in both the Old and the New Testament are a continuous and consistent revelation without deviation from Genesis to Revelation. The same God we read about in Genesis is the same God we read about in Revelation. When we examine God's laws expressed in the Torah, we see its full and final application and expression through the life and teachings of Jesus Christ and the rest of the New Testament writers. As a third emphasis, the concept of the second Moses, prophetically expressed in Deuteronomy 18, has its full realization in Jesus Christ. Indeed, we are to listen to everything that he has said. We are to do everything he has taught and now expanded upon. And so finally, the point of all this is to apply with all the more fervor, all the more understanding of what these things we hear read to us in our Bibles, studied by us in our Bibles, and spoken to us each and every Sabbath. Thank you for the opportunity.